evening. Welcome to The Global Journalist. Your regular host, Stuart Lurie, is away from the mic this week. My name is Rod Gillette. To paraphrase from Stuart's familiar opening lines, this program is dedicated to the idea that despite our deep-in-the-interior U.S. location, there are a lot of people interested in international news. And if you're interested in hearing this program again, or if you have comments, suggestions, questions, even complaints, you can find us on the internet at kbia.org with a link to our internet email address. For weeks now, our international attention has focused on Afghanistan and from time to time on other faraway places which pop up now and then as other designated venues where there are terrorist activities or which are suspected of being terrorist havens. In other words, what we've come to know as the war against terrorism and the many events and places associated with it dominate, understandably, the international news to which Americans pay attention. But what else has gone on, about which we know very little? Is our professed new appreciation of international events actually quite limited? Or to put it another and simpler way, if it isn't terrorism, can it possibly be really news? Well, one of the ongoing stories that fall into that category of events not getting much attention in these parts involves a brand new, full-fledged, independent nation now added to the world lineup. Its new president and government take office in less than 2 weeks. Will your world be any different when that happens? Probably not. But how many times are we witness to the birth of a new country out of a troubled, violent past? The new country to which I refer is East Timor, and for those of us who are geographically and demographically challenged, I'll pass along some basics in a moment. They may surprise you, as will some facts about the even larger country from which East Timor now has separated. We'll find out what's going on there as well, which might very well affect us. Our panelists on this Far Eastern edition of The Global Journalist, in Sydney, Australia, Louise Williams, Asia Specialist for the Sydney Morning Herald, one of the country's major newspapers, and in Jakarta, Indonesia, Richard Galpin, Indonesia correspondent for the BBC. Well, let me ask each of you in turn, starting with Louise Williams in Sydney, give us an idea of what's going on in the area you're covering or the area where you are living. What's the big news story these days?
Well, after listening to your introduction, I have to say somewhat ironically, it's U.S. and Australian relations. So I think Australia has been very much focused on U.S. Policy, particularly the war against terrorism, and has lent virtually unqualified support to America's efforts and troops to Afghanistan. And today's headlines are that the U.S. has announced a very substantial subsidy package for the agricultural sector, which will make American exports cheaper and will compete directly with Australian exports. So the Australian government is feeling... I think a little bit betrayed and very angry about it. So I think that the whole issue of Australia's relationship with the US, the debate is going to continue here because you have a sort of strong sector in the government that thinks, you know, you've got to stick with the most powerful nation on earth, of course. And then we have a very other strong view, which is that we're very far removed geographically from America. We have very different interests, and we really need to look at our neighbourhood, our place in Asia, a lot more carefully. So yes, while you actually want to know what's going on in the rest of the world, Australia's focused on what the US is doing.
The specific issue that you just brought up about agricultural subsidies is something about which we have heard absolutely nothing.
Yes, it's amazing because it's the top of our TV news bulletins, and there's all sorts of, you know, soul searching going on here. And, you know, I suppose fair enough. We export a number of the same products that U.S. Farms do, particularly wheat. And so, of course, the elected government wants to show the people that we actually get something for going to war in Afghanistan, for example, with the US, and it looks a bit like a slap in the face. So we're feeling a little bit like the very powerless junior partner at the moment, I think, tonight.
In Jakarta, Richard Galpin, correspondent for the BBC, Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. What's the big news where you are?
Well, as you know, it's interesting. Also here, the war on terrorism is very much the focus for the media. As you know, Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim nation, and Washington has really put a lot of pressure on the Indonesian government to root out what it believes are a number of Muslim extremists. And there have been a lot of allegations, although not so much evidence, that various radical groups here in Indonesia are connected to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. And Washington has been very unhappy, actually, with the slow speed with which the Indonesian government has reacted, and the fact that it has arrested so far very few people indeed in this connection. But literally just a few days ago, we did finally have the arrest of the leader of one of the most militant Islamic organizations called Lashkar Jihad. And its leader, Jaafar Umar Talib, had been in the Moluccan Islands in the east of the country, where over the past 3 years we've witnessed a very, very bloody religious conflict between the Muslim and Christian communities. They're more or less balanced in that part of Indonesia. And about just over 2 weeks ago, there was a massacre of around about 13 Christians in a village, and it's believed to have been linked to this militant Islamic organization, Lashkar Jihad, and in particular to a speech given by its leader, Jaafar Umar Talib. Now, until now, the government has been really very frightened of tackling these radical groups, and in particular, Lashkar Jihad. But finally, we did have his arrest when he left the Moluccan Islands and was coming back here to the island of Java, and he is now under police arrest. And I think it's not only as a result of his provocative speech and the fact that we believe his organization has been involved in violence, but as a result also of American pressure. He is one person whom the American authorities have singled out. He himself has admitted that back in the late 1980s he was in Afghanistan. He met Osama bin Laden at that time, but he says that he didn't actually agree with bin Laden's philosophy, and that they have not had any links since then. But clearly, the American intelligence agencies believe otherwise, and I'm sure that Washington will be delighted that this man is now under arrest. But the interesting thing is that it is causing really quite acute problems for the government. We have a coalition government here, which includes a number of nationalist parties, but also Islamic parties, and already it is causing splits. We've had the vice president going to actually visit this man in his in the police headquarters just a couple of days ago. So clearly, a number of the main parties and the vice president himself unhappy that this militant leader has been arrested, and clearly they believe that he should not be being detained by the police.
As you happened to mention a few moments ago, Mr. Galpin, that Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, and I had read this someplace that you, 90% of the people are of Islamic, practice the Islamic faith. So how would you say the people themselves view the United States?
I think the majority of people view the United States in a pretty positive way. There are very strong relations between the two countries, and many Indonesians, obviously from the wealthier classes, go to the United States. They have children being educated there. So there are strong links which go back many years between the two countries. But having said that, I think, as you say, the majority of the country, the population here, are Muslims, although I would say generally very moderate Muslims. But I think that there is wariness about this war on terrorism. I think that people see it from an Islamic point of view, that they have seen a country like Afghanistan, where there are fellow Muslims being bombed, and innocent people being killed in that bombing campaign, and have been quite disturbed by that. And I think there is quite a lot of concern that this war on terrorism is going to polarize the world into the Christian or non-Muslim and the Muslim camps. And I think people do worry about that and worry about an extension of the war on terrorism. I think the other point is that this is really quite a nationalistic country which does not like foreign interference. Indonesia has been the subject of colonial rule for hundreds of years, and even after it had independence back in the late 1940s, there was a lot of interference by the Dutch, by the British, and by the Americans. And I think they're very wary and would never, for example, accept American troops coming to this area like they've already done in the Philippines to try and help fight the radical Islamic groups there. So I think that there is a wariness about where this war on terrorism is going to lead to, particularly, obviously, vis-a-vis Southeast Asia.
Yeah, you make reference there to its colonial past, which gives me an opportunity to back us up a little bit in history. We're talking about an area now that we used to know as the Dutch East Indies, right?
That's exactly right. The Dutch East Indies was precisely what became Indonesia after the Second World War, with the exception, of course, of East Timor, which was originally Portuguese and remained in the Portuguese hands up until the mid-1970s. Then with political troubles back home, the Portuguese withdrew, and at that point the Indonesian army invaded and took control of East Timor. Timor is an island, half of which West Timor was part of the Dutch East Indies and therefore was part of immediately part of Indonesia. But then we had this anomaly, if you like, of East Timor, which the Indonesian government at that time, under the former president, Suharto, believed that they could take control of. And indeed, they had, so we understand, the green light from the American president at that time, who happened to pass through Jakarta just a few days before the invasion took place. And the Americans gave the green light, so we understand, to that invasion.
The invasion of East Timor?
That's right, yes, back in 1975. Clearly, obviously, at that time, you know, the world was very much divided into the Cold War with the communist and non-communist states, and the Americans, as far as we understand it, were very worried that or wanted to do everything, if you like, to actually back up President Suharto and make sure he remained within the Western camp. And that kind of realpolitik led to kind of the nod and the green light to actually taking control of East Timor, even though in reality it should never have been part of Indonesia because, as I say, it was not part of that core Dutch East Indies from which Indonesia was molded after the Second World War.
Yes, and I guess the United Nations never recognized Indonesia's claim on East Timor. It's interesting that Indonesia itself gained independence through a struggle with its colonial overseers, if you will, the Dutch. Then Indonesia tried to keep East Timor from gaining independence, and this now allows us to swing our attention perhaps to East Timor, where we had hoped to get a hold of the newspaper editor in the capital city of Dili, but our telephone connections just don't seem to work in trying to reach him at the time we're recording this program. So I'm going to rely on the two of you to tell us a little bit about East Timor. You both have been there, I'm sure, and can describe for us the country itself, and then we'll talk about its emergence officially as a country. Ms. Williams, can you...
Well, certainly, as an Australian, East Timor is a very interesting place to go to because it actually feels like Northern Australia. And when I used to fly in from Jakarta, where I was based for 4 years, it actually felt like going home because a lot of the trees are very similar. It's quite beautiful, very rugged, you know, turquoise seas, very very underdeveloped. I think, you know, with 800,000 people as the newest independent nation in the world, it's going to have to have some very careful management of its financial resources to stay afloat. And Timor does have a share of oil and gas reserves in the Timor Sea. That's a three-way split between Australia, Indonesia, and the independent East Timor. And, you know, hopefully, if there's some very good management of the income from those resources, there's no reason why it can't operate very successfully. But without that kind of income, there's a little bit coming in from coffee. But of course, you know, I'm sure all your listeners will know that virtually the entire infrastructure of the country was destroyed just before it actually gained independence. So I think that, you know, huge challenges ahead for East Timor. And particularly, you know, during the Indonesian period, the Indonesians ran the place. Very few East Timorese received a higher education. So you've got a new country virtually starting from scratch with a shortage of professionals in all areas, from lawyers to draft legislation to doctors and nurses. So that's a very, you know, it's an issue very close to Australia's heart, because Timor is not only just off our northern coast. Obviously, Australian troops were the first in there. We have a lot of East Timorese in our community here too, so it's something that's very close to in Australia's interest.
There was that period, of course, when there was some very violent fighting going on. The Indonesian military was accused almost of committing massacres in that area known as East Timor. And then it kind of dropped off our radar screen, so to speak, once the fighting stopped. So that to know that it has now held an election, it has picked a legislative body, it has elected a president, and suddenly we're reading now about East Timor, the brand new, full-fledged democratic country. That is
certainly didn't drop off Australia's radar.
No, I'm sure.
Our newspaper actually sent a full-time correspondent in and opened an office, so we've been following it step by step. And, you know, there's a huge number of challenges. You know, it's a very, very difficult, very, very difficult task. And I think one of the most difficult tasks for any new nation that's lived under authoritarian rule is to dismantle that system in which you boss each other around and expect jobs for your family and all of that sort of thing. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of structural difficulties for Timor as well, but I'm sure Richard would like to say something.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Galpin. I was going to say the president of Indonesia, as I understand it, is going to go to Dili for the inauguration, the handover, if you will, from the UN administrator of this new country, and that would indicate by her visit that things are now going well between the two countries.
Yes, that's right. We're not absolutely certain whether she will go. I mean, all the indications are that she is planning to do so. And in fact, just a few days ago, we had a visit by East Timor's president-elect, Xanana Gusmao, who came here specifically to hand over personally an invitation to the Indonesian president, Megawati Sukarnoputri, and also to several other senior ministers to ask them and invite them to attend the independence celebrations, which begin on May the 19th. We actually interviewed Xanana Gusmao at the time, and he said that he'd received a very positive response from President Megawati, and the indication was that she was going to come. But it's another interesting situation with the coalition government and the instability of the politics here that President Megawati is quite wary of going. She's certainly concerned about it because there has been opposition officially stated by the parliament. The Foreign Affairs Committee said that she should not go. The Speaker of Parliament said she should not go, and also the Speaker of the Upper Parliament. But that seems to have crumbled away somewhat over the last couple of weeks. They seem to have softened their position, I think particularly because Xanana Gusmao came here and showed a lot of respect to the Indonesian government, and I think he helped win them over. So as I say, it does look like she'll go. We're not quite sure how long she'll spend there. We heard one rumor that maybe she'd literally only be there for a matter of hours and watch the flag-raising ceremony and the swearing-in of the new president and a few other the formal sections of the celebrations and then fly back. But we don't know that for sure.
Now, let me ask each of you. We don't have an opportunity terribly often anyway to watch a whole new country suddenly emerge and join the family of nations, so that we don't have an awful lot in our lifetimes anyway to compare this with. So what's it like? Do we have a country that's lying in ruins? Has it been rebuilt? Is there really great hope for democracy? How would you envision this?
I was going to say Richard's probably been there more recently than I have. I do understand that there's been considerable sort of rebuilding in terms of infrastructure, but I think it's 2.5 years that the United Nations has been there. That's an incredibly short time to unpick the legacy of the past. And one thing Richard mentioned, Shanana Gusmao, is I think worth highlighting, is Shanana Gusmao actually spent many years in Indonesian jails in very difficult conditions. And his ability to seek reconciliation and to show his determination to actually have a good relationship with Indonesia, I think, is very, very important, because one of the huge issues for East Timor, being such a tiny, tiny little pocket, I suppose, surrounded by what is Indonesia, is the fact that from 1975 an enormous number of people died during the Indonesian occupation, and there really is great potential there for a huge amount of resentment. And the other issue is that the Indonesian military officers that did actually orchestrate the violence in 1999 have not actually had any legal penalty applied to them. So to have Shanana in that position, I think, is very fortunate, because he will seek reconciliation and will try to prevent, I suppose, retribution and revenge from motivating the next period in East Timor's history. But that said, it's almost sort of... It's like you were trying to get onto the correspondent Hugo da Costa in East Timor, and you said, well, you only have a mobile phone number. Well, because there's no phone system. The Australian company Telstra has put up the mobile phone system there. I understand that when the UN withdraws, there will not be an internet provider. Legislation is in its infancy. You know, what are the property laws going to be? You have to start right from the beginning. So you can imagine, with a very great shortage of professionals with appropriate training, how difficult that is going to be. And, of course, the other issue is, after all those hard years of fighting for independence, people are really tired, and independence was always going to be this nirvana. But of course, once you get to independence, it's actually almost the beginning of the work then to actually put your country together. So I understand from a number of people I know working there that that's also a great challenge, the fact that people really are exhausted from, you know, decades of guerrilla war, and then, you know, everything was wrecked and they had to start again. So it's going to be a tough job.
Mr. Galpin, do we, when a new country is created, do we just kind of say, okay, there you're on your own, and we let it wither or die, or do other countries mentor it? Australia, Indonesia, the U.S., all of the above?
Oh, certainly there's going to have to be continued massive foreign assistance. Essentially, what we've had since the Indonesians withdrew after the vote for independence back in 1999 has been a fully-fledged United Nations government. You've had a man from the United Nations there who's effectively been like a sort of benign dictator who's been running the place for the past 2.5 years. So what's going to happen actually on independence at midnight on May the 19th is that that UN government, the executive power of the UN in East Timor, will be handed over to an East Timorese government, which is more or less already in place. We already have the parliament, we have the president, we know who the prime minister or first minister, chief minister, whatever they're going to call it, will be. We already have a constitution. So all those fundamentals are already in place. So, but what I'd like to go back to actually to emphasize is just the level of destruction which took place back in 1999 surrounding the vote for independence. As Louise was saying actually earlier on, from the moment of invasion back in 1975 up until that point, I mean, the estimates we don't really know, but according to some, around a quarter of the population died either from the fighting or from famine, from starvation. And then in 1999 there was a massive outbreak of violence, and it appears to have been absolutely systematic. And this was carried out by both the Indonesian military and a number of militia gangs, which they had established, which they had funded, which they had trained, and which for which they had provided the weapons. And they literally went through more or less all the main towns and villages, destroying what they could, tearing out infrastructure, literally looting and taking anything of value away with them and driving it across the border into West Timor, which is part of Indonesia. So it really was starting from ground level zero back in 1999. And you were asking, what is it like now? Well, certainly, yes, there has been a fair amount of rebuilding and reconstruction, but there's still a long way to go. I mean, even in Dili, the capital, you'll still see a lot of burnt-out buildings, and in other parts, more remote areas, it's even worse. So there's still an awful lot of rebuilding to do. It's still a huge task. I mean, the Indonesians did a very good job of making sure that East Timor, if it was going to turn its back on Indonesia, it would have a very, very difficult time being independent. And the logic for the Indonesian army, which has always been the means of keeping Indonesia together, which is a very disparate nation as it is, with many different areas, a huge area, a massive archipelago with very, very different cultures and ethnicities right across it, was very, very worried that other parts of Indonesia would follow the East Timorese example and try and break away as well. There are a number of separatist conflicts in Indonesia still ongoing. So they wanted to make absolutely sure that any of those other separatist groups in different parts of Indonesia would see the lesson which East Timor was being taught, which is if you did try and break away, then you would suffer horribly. One thing, of course, I should mention is that more than 1,000 people were killed in 1999 alone. There were massacres carried out by the militias. We had one where it was three particularly notorious events in which you had dozens of people killed, even priests killed inside a church where a number of independent supporters were sheltering in two towns. So it was a very, very traumatic time for the East Timorese, and they are still suffering from that, and it's going to be, as Louise was saying, it's going to be very, very difficult. So to come back to my earlier point that the need for assistance will be enormous, and we assume that the international community will keep funding the development of East Timor for really quite a few years to come. And we understand that there's going to be a big conference of donor nations just before independence in the week before, so it's actually next week, which they will sit round the table in Dili, the East Timorese capital, and decide exactly how much money they are prepared to spend to keep East Timor afloat, because it'll certainly need many tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to keep it going.
I'm going to have to stop because we have run out of time, I'm sorry to say. I want to thank Richard Galpin, correspondent for the BBC in Jakarta, Indonesia. I want to thank Louise Williams of the Sydney Morning Herald, talking to us from Sydney, Australia. I know at the time we're recording this program, it's very late at night or very early in the morning, and I want to thank you both for staying up with us, so to speak.
Nope.
So, again, thanks to both of
you.
And in Columbia, Missouri, for The Global Journalist, I'm Rod Gillette.